Hey, Lax Coach Mike here, laxcoachmike.com. Premium guys, love you to death. Crossover, you guys are the greatest. Thank you for sponsoring this stuff on the site. Great product, man. I use it. I love it. I encourage you to do it. They just did a press release. You know, I guess they just signed a deal with the NLL, so they'll be providing crossover services to the NLL teams. Gives you an idea of the credibility they have. Hey, listen, this is our first podcast with Coach Jim Nagel from Stony Brook. You may remember him, had a great run as the head coach at Colgate, went to Stony Brook after, Coach Sewell went to Navy, and they got a young team. They're making some real noise. Interesting coach, you know, very, very straightforward in terms of his practice plans and what he does. You know, I might suggest that he's a little bit of a full field, half field, full field guy back and forth. But he does a ton of scrimmaging and is really into letting the players play. And that kind of takes precedent in his practices. Only runs his drills 8 minutes, 10-minute scrimmages, stuff like that. We feature a 4v4 ground ball drill in the article section. I would encourage you to go there and take a look at it. It's a pretty cool look. It's a 4v4 with a ground ball. Anyway, go to the article section, check it out. Again, I found the podcast extremely, extremely interesting and maybe a little different than what I expected. Like I said, straightforward in his plans, but I'll let you listen to Coach describe all this in his own words. Special thanks to Crossover. Special thanks to you. Without further ado, Coach Jim Nagel, Stony Brook.
Hey, that's Coach Mike here. That's CoachMike.com. Today is another great day. We got a new coach with us, Coach Nagel from Stony Brook. You heard in the intro, yeah, just a great career at Colgate and a big year last year and a ton of young players there. It looks like it's going to be another great year at Stony Brook this year. Coach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I'd like to start the interview with the new coaches and understanding, you know, that there's a big difference between a high school schedule and a college schedule, and you put a bunch of your stuff in the fall. But if you had a basic template for a practice plan, or maybe you're changing your practice plans every day, which we're hearing more and more of, can you kind of walk us through what a skeleton practice might look like at Stony Brook with you?
Yeah, well, we try to do two things. We try to focus on our fundamentals, particularly early in practice, and then we try to have an up-tempoed competitive segment of practice. So we'll go like skill work, you know, teaching points early in the practice, maybe the first 10 minutes, and then we ramp up and really try to get a hard moving, hard work in practice where it's up-tempoed, competitive, and then toward the end we may break down and do some specials, but you know, we definitely feel like tempo and work ethic are the most important thing we need to see every day. So sometimes we'll sacrifice some of the instructional component or, you know, schematics to make sure that we get guys playing hard and working hard every day.
So, Coach, kids come out of the locker room and do you stretch before you get into the skill work, or you do immediately into the skill work, and tell me a little bit about what tell our listeners a little bit about what that skill teaching points actually is in real life.
So, you know, they're responsible to look at the practice plan and commit it to the best of their ability to their memory.
You post a plan ahead of time?
We do, and so they know that. And now with, you know, it's kind of amazing the technology. Every kid has an iPad that's issued by the athletic department, and you know, so we actually send them so they can look at it in class or at lunch or wherever they are. So they'll get that, and then you know, they don't have to sort of have everything committed to memory. But you know, we ask them to do the best
right,
of their ability, and you know, they stretch before the start of practice so we can get ready and going right when practice is scheduled to start, so we get the, you know, the stretches out of the way on their own time. And then with the fundamental side, we usually break it up where we have, you know, defensive side of the ball, and then mainly shooting at the offensive end of the field. We have a variety of different shooting drills that we do, and we're really focusing on our release time, which is something that you can see progressively with our guys. You know, the freshmen come in and they usually have hitches and security cradles before they release their shot. And so we spend a lot of time with the young guys working
on. Yeah, you can always tell the guys that got cages in the backyard.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Shooters for shoot, you know. So we definitely understand that and make sure we get a lot of reps in practice, but also make sure that the reps are quick release reps.
Cool. So after 10 minutes there, where do we go now, Coach?
So then we're looking at kind of moving into drill work. Whether it's, you know, like defensive drills or ground ball drills or transition drills, we try to hit our points in about 30 seconds and then drill it for, you know, good 8 minutes and then on to the next drill. We try to keep tempo between the drills. And then, you know, the variety, we'll usually do like two or three drills, and then we'll mix in like a 10-minute scrimmage where we usually put a parameter on. It's competitive scrimmage, so we're keeping score. The loser usually runs, and then we'll usually put a parameter on it, like a simple parameter of some point that we're trying to focus on that practice or that week. You know, it could be as simple as, you know, every ground ball is a goal. You know, if we're trying to push transition or take transition away, focusing on that fundamental, then we'll say transition goals are worth three. You know, if we're trying to look at shot selection, focus on shot selection, we'll say goalie saves are a goal. So, you know, we just try to find parameters that encourage our guys to play within our teaching points in our system.
Jim, do you put situational work in there too? I mean, are you inserting
the situational would be more
goal or later, or you do that later in practice?
Yeah, you know, a situation would be at the end because it's a little slower tempoed.
Okay.
But we do do like adversity type scrimmages where maybe there's an extra guy on D or an extra guy on O. You know, most of the time, that's when you have your first team against your second team. But most of the time, it's split up equally as we want to keep it competitive and keep, you know, everybody have an opportunity to earn playing time.
So, Coach, what are we, about 20, 25 minutes in now, maybe 30 minutes in?
Yeah, and we'll do that. You're 35, 40 minutes in. And then we'll do, you know, after the scrimmage, then we'll go back to some more drill work. Again, whatever we think we need to work on. Most of the time, it's our base principles of, like, you know, ground ball, reversal, and, you know, just all basic fundamentals. And then coming back to a scrimmage later in practice. So we go, like, maybe 25 minutes of drill work, you know, usually 8-minute segments, and then another 10-minute scrimmage. Then we just take that kind of to the end, and at the end we're looking at special situations, whether it's man up, man down, or, you know, or riding clear or set plays or whatever it might be.
Yeah, do you run your man up, man down at the end?
We run our man up, man down at the end, but we also, it depends, like if we have a lot to go over, then we want to spend a lot of chunk of time on it. Then we'll run it at the end. If we just want to get some reps in, we'll mix it in the middle of practice. So in between like a heavy competitive segment, we'll come and just do one or two quick man up, man downs, and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah, we've seen that much, much more this year. Actually, you know, this year has been a crazy. It's funny, man. Every year over the 5 years, we kind of see a new trend. Not across all the coaches, but across a relatively large sample of the coaches. You know, this year I have to say, you know, what we saw was an increase in coaches practicing timeouts and actually practicing halftime.
Yeah, I mean, I'm I think that's great and probably an area where we need to improve on situations. And I'm more of a coach, more of a player's game, you know. So, like, I feel like sometimes you can try to control too much and overthink things. And if you're not getting ground balls, you're not winning games.
Right. I'm looking at the ground ball stats, 614 to 534. I mean, 80 or 90 more than your competition over the season.
Yeah, I mean, when you win games, if you look back at our previous years when we were struggling a little bit, it would probably be reversed. So I think it's a pretty important stat.
Coach, you have a general philosophy on your ground balls, drilling in practice. One-on-one, two-on-ones, 2v2s. I mean, we talk with some level of disdain, I guess. Hope it don't piss you off, man. You know, we get so many guys out there that just don't know, you know, other options and have, you know, been running the traditional 2v1 where you roll the ball into the parking lot and 18 guys are throwing dirt on each other or talking about Lucy. We're seeing more 1v1 ground balls where a guy's starting to drill with a 1v1 ground ball and the guy that gets it is in, the other guy's out. I mean, all that kind of stuff.
Anything you can do.
Philosophies that you're following on how you're getting the guys prepared to win the ground ball war?
Yeah, I mean, one's conditioning. Obviously, work ethic and toughness are important when you're going for the ground ball and being competitive. But I also think a lot of times what's overlooked is this actual skill of getting the ground ball. And having a low cradle when you come out instead of bringing that thing right up and staying low. So we will rep, particularly with our face-off guys, a lot of ground balls. I mean, we'll just skeleton ground balls, and they'll be doing 100 ground balls, just working on their low cradle and keeping it tight and really repping the ground balls at one time in them. You know, I see a lot of people doing, create situations where a guy's got to one-time the ground ball with token pressure or heavy pressure, and I think that's really important, and it's a skill, you know. So you talk about toughness and effort, which is a big part of getting the ground ball, but it's also a skill, and, you know, there are a lot of fundamentals that everybody teaches, but usually the guys with the best skill come up with the ground ball. I mean, you look at some guys don't necessarily have the greatest fundamentals going for the ground ball, but because their skill is so good, they come up with it and they one-time it and get it every time.
Coach, I have to tell you, for an island guy, you sound reminiscent of a Coach Massera coaching clinic there.
Yeah, is that right?
You know, right. I mean, obviously, you know, people in the game for a long time, you know, young coaches, a lot of them don't even know who Massera is, which is tragic. Eh?
Oh, he's legendary.
But, you know, he doesn't do a lot of clinics because he's pretty close to the vest. I actually talked to him about coming on. He wouldn't come on. You know, he didn't want to share.
Uh-huh.
Which, more power to him. I mean, how can you argue with his greatness or how many lives he's touched and everything else, you know? But I have been to a couple of his coaching clinics way, way back when, you know, probably 10 or 12 or 14 years ago. And, man, I remember the drills, you know, with, you know, ground ball by four cones and the kids picking it up. And then his other big thing was head-to-head. You know, as soon as you got the ground ball, the head of the stick had to be right by your helmet. And legend says that, you know, I think there's a lot of legends, but one of them was, you know, the cages didn't come out for 2 weeks, you know, when they started practice early in the year, just working on stick work fundamentals. But there's another legend that I don't think has ever been confirmed, that he used to put bungee ties like 18 inches on the sticks and the helmets, you know,
mm-hmm.
and had the guys running bent over as if they came off a ground ball cradling with the bungee cord tying the stick to the helmet.
Right, right.
Like I said, I'm not saying it's true in this day and age of child abuse and coach abuse and, you know, not touching players and all that. I'm not saying that. But at the end of the day, it certainly reinforced the fundamental.
Yeah, well, I mean, he would be one of the best ever at coaching fundamentals and teamwork. So,
well, they had pretty good coaching staff at Ward Melville too, I think. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, that wasn't bad.
Coach Kuzos.
That wasn't bad. That wasn't bad.
Two of the biggest high school legends ever in Messer and Kuzo. So, you know, definitely national legends as well as New York State.
No doubt. No doubt. Coach, you talked about in the drill work, you just made a comment, and I'm taking notes as feverishly as I can. Ground ball reversal, you know, and we hear more and more over the last 2 years about even starting a transition drill or whether it would be a half field or a full field. It seems like the mantra of ground ball pass or scoop pass, as some coaches say, has become an inherent part of practice. Are you doing ground ball pass, and can you describe to the coaches a little bit about how you might do a drill where there's a ground ball and a reversal and what the fundamental and the philosophy is that you're trying to drive home?
Sure. I think that pass concept is definitely a West Jenny, something they preached all the time. And ball movement from Ward Melville and Coach Kuzo. So all those things are deep in the roots of New York State high school lacrosse. But our basic principle, like in any sport, you pick up the loose ball, the defense is heavy to the ball side of the field, and swinging the ball to the weak side is always a good idea. It's where the defense isn't, and the ball moves faster than you do. So two things we talk about there are thinking ahead. So kind of knowing where you are. And first of all, if you have an opportunity to compete for the ground ball, you compete for it, and you go for the ground ball and you work to try to win the ball. But then if you're not in the vicinity of the ball, thinking ahead, having a plan offensively, and knowing where you are in relation to the ground ball. We talk about that a lot because guys are going to be in different spots. We drill it almost every day. Because they have to react to where they are on the field in relation to the ball. So,
If he doesn't go for the ground ball, he's establishing a legitimate adjacent passing lane or something like that.
Exactly. So you're okay. Supporting two adjacent passes. The guy with the guy who scoops through the ground ball is running the daylight and throwing the ball to the first stick he can get the ball to. We support both adjacents. And then we're swinging the ball to the backside. The guy on the backside is getting deep and setting himself up for a dodge, which we try to get him immediately to do as he receives the ball. So he's thinking one step ahead. Defensively, we call it relational ground balls, where the players who are not competing for the ground ball are now thinking ahead and preparing for the next play, which in most cases on a defensive half-field situation, in a half-field situation or a third of the field situation, those off-ball defenders are not just floating around staring at the ball. They're assuming transition defense responsibility. So as the guys are going for that ground ball, they should be in tight to the crease and organized accordingly. Then if their team picks up the ball defensively, you know, they're in position where they can spoke out and redirect the ball to clear it. But if the other team picks it up, you know, they're not so stretched out where the ball is going to get underneath them.
So, Coach, you mind sharing with us what that drill looks like, where the guys are on the field and how you
We can do it in a variety of different ways.
Right.
Do 4-on-4 is kind of a real good way to get the guys supporting the adjacent and really getting to spots with less guys out on the offensive third. And then we can build it up to a 6-on-6. But really it's just rolling a ball out in a offensive third situation repping
so
it out.
The offensive players and the defensive players, Coach? Or are you just running this like a scramble?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
When you start this drill, where are the offensive and the
defensive? It's just like, they're on the field in the offensive third, and you roll a ball out, they play it, and then you roll in another ball out. You usually do sets of threes and then rotate a group in. What you're trying to do is get guys – in different areas of the field in different situations so they can read and react to where they are in relation to the ground ball.
So you're not really, I mean, this drill doesn't have lines. These guys
are
somewhere near the offensive box.
Yeah, it's like, it's in sets, you know. So the other guys are off the half, you know, on the sideline.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
In the early days of the site, you know, when we were getting started, most of the guys were running their 4v4s in either a front Y or a back Y. Are you doing that, or what kind of set do you have these? Do you like these guys to be set up in when you start this drill?
No, it's more flow, as I was getting into the before. I mean, we're more teaching concepts and flow than we are teaching sets and schemes. So I don't really care where they are. They're just out there.
Okay.
It almost is helpful if you have guys in different spots or you're overloaded, so you have three guys on the ball side of the field and you got to get one guy support and then you got to get another guy to the back side of the field and he's got to sprint and get there and really work hard to stick with the plan of getting the ball to the weak side of the field. So we're much more principally driven than schematically driven.
And the guy that's sprinting out, did he get to the weak side? Is he high or low?
It depends which way the ball swings. So if the ball is going through X, then he's, you know, supporting
right.
low. If the ball is coming up across the top, then he's usually high. It's really about keeping, you know, thinking ahead, moving your feet so the ball doesn't stall.
Right.
Because a lot of times it doesn't really matter. You always have space over there, so it doesn't really matter kind of where you are.
Good stuff, man. Good stuff. Kid's favorite transition drill, Coach?
I don't know. We call it a wolf drill. It's a real common drill. It's a full field drill. Guys at the midline.
Right.
Two lines of guys on one, two lines of, we'll say, red and white, two lines of white, one line of red on one side, and vice versa on the other side. And then so it's a two-on-one ground ball. If the one picks it up, then the other side gets released. And, you know, you got a two-on-one advantage on the other side being released.
It's either a 5-on-4 or a 4-on-4 coming up.
Exactly. Well, it's even numbers, but you have it's lopsided on the sides of the field, so you usually have an advantage, even though it's, you know, so you have a 5-on-5, but usually you have some advantage because of where guys are on the field.
Right.
If the one picks it up, if the two pick it up, then we just push a 54.
Understanding that the, you know, one of the big things we try and do on the site, Jim, is convert a full field 40-man roster drill down to where a high school coach that has 28 or 30 guys, you know, that can walk and chew gum on the roster into a half field. Oh, that was another question I wanted to ask you. Wasn't Rick legendary for, you know, like 32, 34-man rosters? The first thing I did when I was preparing for this interview was count the amount of players. You're back up to a more traditional D1 roster size.
Yeah, I mean,
so
I...
When
I,
you first
I,
got there, what, didn't he... Isn't that something he used to do? Or, I mean, just have like 32, 34 guys on the roster?
Or
am I wrong?
You know what? I can't really speak to that. I don't know.
Yeah.
You'd have to speak to Rick, but... Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's advantages and disadvantages of being small in rosters and heavy in rosters. I mean, small side is having a small roster, you know, it's easier to keep people happy. But sometimes not having the depth can hurt you, especially with injuries. So I think I always thought ideal number on a roster is anywhere from like 40 to 44. I think when you get into that, some schools are at 50, some schools even higher.
Hey, I'll tell you who's crazy is the D3 schools, man.
Yeah, well...
I mean, I went down to watch a year or so ago. Kadelka's a good friend of the site, and Cannabinet's been on a number of times. And, you know, they were playing in Lynchburg. I was coaching at Auburn, you know, and we were happened to be playing Liberty the same weekend. So I went up a couple days early, you know, and spent a half a day with... Stevenson and a half a day with Lynchburg Obviously, both teams were playing great at the time, you know.
Yeah.
Just to watch, you know, the practices and talk to the coaches, because I was going to be there anyway, you know,
sure.
And both
sure.
of them know us from the site. But holy mackerel, man, both those teams had like 65, 67-man rosters. Yeah, the guys came out of the building. It was like watching the clowns come out of the VW when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, it's never
yeah.
ending.
Yeah, well, it is.
I don't know what you do with 65 guys, you know.
Yeah, it is. That's a lot of guys to manage, especially if you only got three coaches. But, you know, I think with the growth of the game and so many people interested in playing and so many people loving the game, it's great that those D3 schools can provide that kind of opportunity for all those guys. For me, that would be a lot to handle. You know, I would be afraid.
I get
that,
it, man. Hey, I understand. You know, I understand completely. I mean, being a MCLA team, you know, when I was at Auburn, we would get like 70 guys trying out. You know, and a lot of, you know, when we would get about four or five D1 transfers a year, you know, guys that
sure.
made the wrong decision, you know,
exactly.
whether the culture wasn't right or the size of the school wasn't right or mom and dad went to Auburn and that alumni legacy at Auburn is like off the chart, you know, I mean, those people
is it?
Not,
yeah, I bet.
You know, people coming up to me saying, you know, War Damn Eagle and, yeah, I mean, crazy. But anyway, yeah, having 70 for a week, you know, was always a challenge because, you know, I got a feeling we're kind of the same in that if I see eight guys standing around for like 4 minutes, to me it's like fingernails going down a chalkboard, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
it just drives me crazy, man. I can't yeah. I can't have anybody standing around.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's it. You know, the some of the bigger some of the programs that carry bigger rosters, you know, there's no way around it. I think, you know, some of the guys you're going to get you know, it's going to be on them to get the practice in because there's no way you can spend time with everybody and you got to prioritize. So, you know, like I said, I think there's advantages and disadvantages, but with a bigger roster, you're certainly not able to spend time with every kid, you know, with only three coaches.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man. I digressed. Let me go back to the 4v4 with the ground balls.
Yeah.
If a guy picks up the ground ball, and he can get in time and space or time and room, do you let him shoot, or are we so reinforcing to the backside pipe or to the weak side that if you pick up the ground ball, you and maybe it's two passes, maybe it's three. I mean, forget about that for a second. But, you know, kind of like a stipulation, when they pick up the ground ball, they got to get to the backside or the weak side or, you know, weak side top if they're redirecting up, you know, the top of the box and whatnot. Do you make them throw those passes as an inherent part of what we're trying to teach in the drill, or do you let them play it out?
No, I mean, we pretty much try to swing it all the time. I mean, if the guy picks up a ground ball and nobody's on him and he has a shot, I mean, that's a pretty easy goal. So, you know, in a game, they're probably just going to shoot that, you would hope. But, you know, we're not thinking that those are the typical opportunities. I mean, typically when the ball hits
right.
the ground, you're not going to be all alone like that.
Yeah, and I guess, Jim, in the back of my head, what I'm trying to do is modify your philosophy there and how it might apply to a high school coach. You know,
yeah, no, I think you know,
he isn't as disciplined, you know, in terms of, you know, they've got a miscommunication oftentimes, you know, on who's got the ball, especially if we're focusing, you know, so hard on bringing them back to the crease or bringing them back to the hub or whatever the coach wants to call it.
Yeah, I mean, anytime we work with young kids, we're teaching these same fundamentals. I do think quick release fundamentals with young kids or high school kids without a ton of experience are the most, you know, quick release fundamentals, skill fundamentals are probably the most important thing I would harp on. But we would teach these same ground ball fundamentals at every level, really. I mean, any sport you have, I mean, if you watch youth soccer or youth basketball, I mean, you know, kids are swinging the floor in basketball and they're switching fields in soccer. I mean, it's all the same stuff, and they're able to do it at those levels in those sports. So I wouldn't think any differently with lacrosse.
So, Coach, can you share with us a transition drill that could be run on a half field? You have something?
Yeah, we do.
You're running 3v2 or 4v3 or 5v4?
We do a lot of touches the restraining box or touch a scramble. where you know, the defensive guy will call out a name, and he just has to touch the sideline. So we're going from a even situation to a transition situation, where offensively we've got to step in, get in a triple threat position, and get the ball popping and move it to the open guy. And then defensively, we've got to recognize, communicate, right, and, you know, we call it crash, but get in tight and kind of play the percentages, and try to give up the outside shot.
No, man, good stuff. Hey, I'm going to totally switch gears on you here. Is that okay?
That's fine.
I'm looking at the man-up percentage at 485. I think the NCAA average last year was 29 or 30. And you know, you had everything I read. I mean, you got a couple of great goal scorers there that still have a couple of years with you. Any philosophy or general attribute you could attribute to the success that you had on Man Up in terms of percentage?
Well, my assistant coach Craig Gibson is you know, been with me a long time and is a tremendous offensive coordinator. And so it all starts with skill development, I think. You know, we have sort of simple changes in sets, but again, we're more of a flow team and more of a
not set plays necessarily.
Yeah, we're less of a schematic team than we are teaching the guys how to play and a flow team. So we're typically on the man up. Coach Gibson will like to, you know, do three-man barrels or anything to get the defense moving, so that we can get the ball moving and enable our guys opportunities to make decisions. And that's really what we're about. And then the shooting and the quick release fundamentals and our individual sessions are really probably why we've had more success. We also preach sharing the ball all the time, and we really try to pick our man up people based on who can pass the ball as opposed to who can shoot the ball. You know, like if you can't make decisions and pass the ball, we're gonna get the ball out quick, we don't think you can effectively play man up regardless of how hard you can shoot it.
Good stuff, man. What's the preferred set there, Coach? Are you guys running 3-3 there?
Yeah, we usually end in a 3-3. You know, that's kind of our end set. We start a number of different ways, but like I said, I mean, it's pretty basic. We just try to keep a little bit of movement so we don't get stale and just kind of trust our guys to make the right decisions.
You know, we get, I bet you 25% of my emails, Jim, are guys that are, you know, now, I mean, it's just a different world, isn't it? I mean, you can watch NCAA lacrosse all day Saturday and all day Sunday if you tape a few games, you know.
It is.
And they see the guys, you know, morphing in and out of sets. But, you know, I think for probably, I don't know, I don't have any empirical data. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I would guess that, you know, 3-3 is far and away the most prominent set, you know, where they're kind of bouncing the wings back behind GLE and bringing them back up. And looking for those skip lanes, or even running cutters out of it, you know, and ending up in a 1-4 or a 2-3 or 3-2, whatever. But the emails I get from the high school coaches, they just can't get it backed up, you know. I mean, they try and run 3-3, trying to emulate what you're doing at Stony Brook, you know, but they just have such a hard time disciplining, you know, the players to get it backed up.
Right. I don't know that there's
a general comment for those guys, or
yeah, I don't know that there's an answer for that other than you know, being more patient on your shot selection so you don't miss. You know, those two guys got to be creeping in at the pipes and being.
Now, isn't that the most clever response out of an NCAA coach in 2015? Yeah, you don't miss. You don't have to back it up.
Yeah.
I'm going to write that down, Coach. That's why you're Coach of the Year right there, man. That's an awesome one. I got to hand it to you.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, there's no answer because those two guys on the pipe really got to be creeping in. So outside of just really whatever you can do to discipline them. But I do think there's a lot to be said for patience and ball movement and not wild shooting.
Coach, one more question, and we'll get to the camps. I know you got another meeting. I haven't heard you talk a lot about the polls, and not that, and I'm anxious to know how much you integrated in. We haven't talked a lot about polls on the offensive side or transition, or do you run some of the polls up there in the wolf drill? How much offense are polls playing in a Coach Nagel at Stony Brook practice?
Yeah, I mean, we encourage our guys to have the best stick skills that they possibly can have. I mean, we're always calling it a skill game. The team with the best skill wins. And so offensively with our long poles, we will give them a lot of freedom and encourage them to push transition and to cut without the ball and to stay on as long as they can. Although we do not have a heavy diet of sort of offense, you know, 6-on-6 offense with.
Right. No, I get it.
Like some you know, you see Tufts or Brown or some of those schools where they are leaving those guys on to play 6-on-6. We haven't at this point. I think.
Yeah, especially if he's left-handed. You know?
Yeah. But, you know, so, like, we haven't had a real – we haven't found that to be – we have some extraordinary polls with their skill and their athleticism, but we haven't had that found that to be the most effective thing for at least our team to do.
No, I understand it's 6v6, but are you actually letting those guys play some O in a 3v2 or a 5v4?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you got to, and – you know, shooting with the long pole is very difficult for a goalie to pick up. So, you know, that we do it all the time. I mean, and a lot of our poles are converted midfielders, you know, offensive players. So, you know, they're certainly capable and many times more capable in transition.
Coach, I want to be respectful of your time. Talk to me a little bit about the Nagel camps up at Stony Brook.
We have a website, Lacrosse Events, and, you know, we do a lot of, individual sign up, and try to, you know, there are prospect camps that are out there. Our prospect camp is a little bit different. You know, some of the I think ours is more of a showcase where we have, we just had one this past weekend where we had 25 other coaches.
October 25th or something it was.
So we have, it's a little different. I mean, you lose some of the intimacy of what the prospect camp is, but it creates more value in a sense because we have 25 other coaches paid on staff from all different types of schools, so that if you know, Stony Brook's not the fit for you, you're still getting value and exposure from the other coaches.
Yeah, we tell people all the time, and we're big proponents on the site, I think. You know, and I coached, I think, 500 travel ball games, you know, in 5 years, and we were blessed, won the Dix Championship and tournaments in Canada and Denver and everything else out of Atlanta, believe it or not. And, but yeah, I really think the prospect camp and even a modified prospect showcase camp like you're running there is as good or better alternative for kids that are sinking, parents that are sinking boo-coo money and travel money into, travel teams, you know, just because so many guys transfer, man, or so many guys, you know, you recruit 14 and you lose 4 because it wasn't a good fit.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
even necessarily grades or the girlfriend, or I mean, I don't want to be sophomoric in my response, you know, but yeah, getting on campus and meeting the coaches and getting a feel for the campus, I just think is such a huge thing compared to travel ball.
Well, there are a ton of travel teams and a ton of tournaments. There's not, you know, a ton of opportunities that, you know, to come and play in front of college coaches on a Division I campus with, you know, Division I coaches and high-level competition. You know, a lot of the tournaments are out there. I mean, there's so many of them, you know, you may only have, you know, sometimes you have no coaches there, and other times you have a very small number just because there's only so many coaches to go around.
Well, and who knows if the lawn chair is pointed at your field and your quarter when you're playing attack.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about what we're doing, I think, is that, you know, the coaches, the college coaches are in there coaching you as opposed to just sitting in the chair kind of taking notes. So.
Oh, really? How cool is that? Good.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it gives an advantage. I think that's an advantage of the prospect days, that the coaches are actually interacting with the kids as opposed to just sitting in the chair.
Well, man, hey, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I want to be respectful of your time. Love to have you back, Coach, if you'd be willing to come back in
sure, anytime.
A year or so. And I really appreciate you sharing all this, especially the renewed emphasis on ground balls. You know, we do coaching clinics with where we share everything that we learned, you know, and here's how they run 4v3 at this school, here's how they run it at this school, here's what they focus on. You know, you hear high school coaches say that picking up ground balls is nowhere near as challenging as it was when we played, you know, when the field had rocks and big tufts of grass and everything else. And maybe picking them up on turf is a lot easier than picking them up on that kind of application. But
right.
At the end of the day, the bottom line is picking them up, you know. And what do you do with it once you pick it up, you know? And I think I haven't heard anybody, oh, my goodness, since I heard Masira, you know, talk about the low cradles and getting into a real hard cradle as soon as you pick up the ground ball. So really, really good stuff. Thank you so, so much.
Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Hope you got some notes. I got 4 pages here. Special thanks to Coach Jim Nagel. We'll make sure we get him back. Keep an eye on this program, and this certainly looks like we try and keep these timeless, Coach, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, 2015, 2016 look like really, really good years at Stony Brook. So
hope you're right.
Watch him whenever you can, man.
All right.
This is Lex Coach Mike. Hang on with me, Coach. It's Lex Coach Mike, LexCoachMike.com. Remember, you got an amazing, amazing responsibility influencing the lives of these young people. Until next time, God bless everybody.